You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Our next guests have been studying race and ethnicity from different perspectives, but both have looked at what race and ethnicity have meant in society, in education, in politics, and essentially in power, both historically and in the present day. Professor David Livingston Smith joins us. He teaches philosophy at the University of New England. He's written 7 books, and his most recent is called Less Than Human: Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. Garrett Albert Duncan is a professor of education in arts and science and holds an appointment in African and African American studies at the Washington University in St. Louis. Professor Duncan studies schooling as a moral enterprise, exploring the intersection of moral and political contexts in our education systems. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have both of you back here with us again, talking about really important topics today about race and racism. David Livingston Smith, we should start with you because you've been writing about this from a philosophical perspective about what race really is in contrast to, say, ethnicity. Maybe we should start there so that we can understand racism in this context.
So start with the supposed contrast between race and ethnicity. Well, what's supposed to be the case is that ethnic categories are cultural categories and racial categories are biological categories. So you're supposed to be able to change your ethnicity, but not your race. But in fact, that's not how it works. The two categories are frequently conflated, and ethnicities very easily get transformed into racial notions. A very good example is the category Hispanic, which is properly an ethnic category, but is de facto becoming a racial category.
Explain that a little more.
Well, people treat Hispanic people as a racial group. They're thought, people who racialize, that is, they think of Hispanic people as fundamentally distinct from themselves and as having certain characteristics, of course, undesirable characteristics. That always happens when people racialize others. They think of them as less than themselves.
Garrett Duncan, what do you say to this?
I concur with the professor. I will say also, or reinforce, on the one hand, the notion of Hispanic, one could be of various races and be Hispanic. One could be white and be Hispanic. One could be a first world and be Hispanic. One could be black and be Hispanic. It has much to do with culture and language, as the professor indicated. But also, I'd like to add on that the prevailing notion is race is a social construct. And when folks refer to it as a social construct, they speak of it, they use the vocabulary of social, but the language, the grammar is usually psychological. So it's something that's in our head that is discriminatory or prejudicial. I follow the late political scientist Manning Marable, who indicates that race is first and foremost a relationship of power. It involves everything that has already been stated, but it has to do, there's something material about it. It has to do with those who define, not only define reality, but also who accord treatment to others according to that reality.
David Livingston Smith, let's talk about this. You even mentioned in another interview how this idea of being a social construct, people say it, but they don't even know what they're talking about. How do you respond to all this?
Oh, well, I agree with my counterpart. I think race is a social construct. It's a function of history and economics, and particularly in the context of colonization. So I think that the notion of race really has racism built into it. It can never be an innocent
Absolutely.
Notion. It's a hierarchical notion. It was very helpful for Europeans in particular to think of those whom they enslaved and oppressed and those from whom they extracted immense wealth as
Right.
being fundamentally distinct from themselves, as being another kind of human being or a subhuman being. And that's how race works. So, yeah, I quite agree. Race is the very notion of race has power and oppression implicated in it.
Both of you have put race and racism and how it manifests itself into historic contexts. I thought it might be really good to talk about some of that history. David Livingston Smith, why don't you start how history matters?
Well, I go against some of the received wisdom here. I think the notion of race, properly understood, is much more pervasive and much more ancient than I think the majority of scholars think. So the majority of scholars think that the notion of race arose sometime in, say, since the late 15th century. And there's dispute over when the crucial period was. Some people say it was the racialization of Jews in Spain. Some say it was the slave trade. Some say it was the colonization of Native Americans in the New World, and so on and so forth. Whenever people think of other groups of people as fundamentally distinct from themselves, of being really, in a very basic level, irredeemably of a different kind. And that sort of distinction is typically made in a context of struggles for power, or a context in which one group blatantly oppresses another. That's where we get, I think, is the essence of race. And so the notion of race takes different forms throughout history. And we can trace this really back to the ancient world. But of course, the notions of race which are current in our civilization now quite rightly are said to date from the last few hundred years. Now, a really good illustration of this is the attitudes towards Native Americans that Europeans had when they colonized North America. Initially, Europeans thought of Native Americans as white. That was before there was a great deal of conflict, political conflict, colonization conflict with Native Americans. As Europeans started grabbing more and more land, and as conflict arose, you saw the racial transformation of Native Americans from white to tawny to the savages, the red savages, the barely human or subhuman savages. A characterization which was, you know, well established in the late 18th, early 19th century.
Garrett Duncan, you've also looked at this historically, particularly in the U.S., and the role of education.
Absolutely. And my take on history doesn't necessarily differ from the professor's. It takes a different form. I also study time, and I see history, the notions of time as history as being in the past is something of a myth. On the one hand, we always live in the past, present, and the future. We're always in the present as living beings. When we have memories, that's part of the past that we hold in the present. And when we anticipate and look forward, that's in the future, which is also in the present. I believe the operative terms that I heard were manifestation and oppression. There's a face on the nature of race and racism, especially in the United States. And I'll give you an example that there's received notions of how certain expressions are made. For example, when black folks are offended, when we're told that we're articulate, it's not only offended at the assumption that a president of the United States, who's well-trained at some of the elite universities, can speak, who is as well-spoken and as eloquent as any other person, but it goes back to an origin that articulation is a metaphor that actually refers to anatomical features, that we're articulate, that we're surprised that you have the anatomical capacity to actually utter sounds that sound like human beings, i.e. white people. That's why our speech, whether of different racial backgrounds, our indigenous languages, whether it's from our Bantu heritage, is mocked as either black English or slang. And when students were integrated into predominantly white schools under the leadership of white teachers and white administrators, many times these students who actually had, who were educated previously by black teachers and administrators, who actually went to elite, who were more qualified on paper because they were excluded from the southern institutions, they were often referred to as unusual Negroes because there was surprise at in the fact that their well-spokenness, their capacity to do science, to engage in the humanities. And also to put a face on it, even today, I use the metaphor, I think the metaphor of progress. We hear on the various pundits speak of the great amount of progress in race relations. I think that notion is received and is flawed. Rather, it's a tug of war, whether we talk about the past, the real past, or the present. We go back and forth and back and forth. What we see happening in the United States has occurred during our lifetime, back with Rodney King and Latasha Harlins, and even before during the Black Power and the Civil Rights Movement. And we see with other groups, the gender equality as well as the women's rights movement. I will also say it has a very profound effect. For example, today, in the past few days, we've had a 7-year-old second grader who's under 4 feet tall and weighs less than 50 pounds, who was handcuffed and taken from his classroom because he was crying because he was being bullied in his second grade class. So the officer, when he refused the officer's demand to stop crying, the officer placed him in handcuffs and took him away. You see this also happening with other groups whose teachers are threatening to lower their grades because they fail to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. So, and we see the same types of notions of patriotism, the same notions of not how to think but what to think, or certain notions of behavior or what is appropriate conduct that is unevenly and contradictorily attributed to students based upon their phenotypes.
David Livingston Smith.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I think the degree to which these grotesqueries persist is widely underestimated by white people in this country, who are, in general, really quite ignorant of the history, that the amount of ongoing oppression that has been directed against people of African descent. The cartoon version of history is, well, there was slavery, and that ended in 1865, and then, 100 years later, there was the Civil Rights Movement, and that just, if you accept that sort of cartoon version of the history of the oppression of African Americans, nothing about the present so-called race relations is intelligible.
Garrett Duncan, you've also written about how the education system actually becomes sort of a route to putting African Americans and other people of color into prison.
Yes. Previously, the notion, the metaphor, or the catchphrase was school to work. But because of the shifts in our economy from manufacturing to service work, and the displacement of jobs overseas, and now we have the school to prison pipeline, or the school to despair pipeline, as black folks who may be just as qualified as other folks are being denied access to the same quality of life, the same privileges. We also, has come out recently, and there are a number of reports that back this up, that there's a distinction also made between a person of African descent in the U.S. who refers to herself or himself as black, or who refers to himself or herself as African-American. The treatment is different, whether it's in the classroom or even in the courtroom.
And how does that difference manifest itself? If somebody calls themselves black versus African-American, what would be the difference?
The difference is that we've called ourselves many things throughout history. African-American is not a recent invention, although it's often attributed, its currency is attributed to Jesse Jackson's electoral campaign, and he was actually pressured into saying, we are no longer black, we're not a skin color, we are African-American. African-American, it has the attributes of being fundamentally an American and being a part of the American, i.e. white culture. References to black invoke imagery of the Black Panther Party or the so-called black Muslims. Muslims in the Nation of Islam never refer to themselves as black Muslims. They are characterized as black Muslims by those outside of the movement or even the so-called Orthodox Islam. And so the whole notion of black aligns itself with those metaphors that brings to mind anger. If you think about, it's all right to tell a white lie, but it's bad to tell a black lie. Angels are white. The devil is black. If we are saddened, we have a blackened spirit. But if we're uplifted, our hearts are light and merrifull. And so the notion of black is attached to all these time-worn, destructive and negative characteristics, whereas American is often conflated with whiteness. But to be American is a very heterogeneous, variegated, and textured category. Whiteness, I heard a pundit tell on a news show recently, it was a congressperson who indicated or stated plainly that all civilization originated with Europeans. And when he was asked to be transparent, he said, yes, what we would call white people. But if you think about the United States, many of our characteristics are just so folded and layered into the people that the real bodies that constitute America.
If language is really meaningful like this, right?
Yeah.
So and has that powerful of an effect, then should we choose the words that we use to identify ourselves differently?
You know, I will say that vocabularies change inevitably, but the grammars are quite more tenacious. So one could be called an African-American and still be seen as black and still be exacted upon the same types of violence, both emotional, psychological, but in my view, really importantly, the material, tangible violence of violence being exacted upon black bodies. So it's not so much a language. Language is really powerful insofar as power is the capacity to present a particular reality and to have others buy into that reality as though that reality is self-evident. But there are many realities brought to bear in everyday life.
I also often wondered if using the language of black people and white people created a dichotomy. And I'm Armenian. I don't consider myself white, but people would call me white.
Precisely. I believe that creation was a result of white supremacist power structures. Folks, and I will say back in the day, I'll go with that model of history, Africans who enslaved Africans who were either brought here or who traveled here outside of the slave ships, they often refer to them themselves in terms of their ethnicity. One thing that's unknown to most folks, that the lingua franca among Africans in the colonies was actually Wolof, which is an African language. We would speak one way in integrated settings. We would speak the lingua franca of the U.S., which would be English, but among ourselves, it would be Wolof, and because a sort of an identification with our African heritages. But we're then again, in public, we're thrust into this notion of blackness.
David Livingston Smith.
Yeah, I'm so happy to hear that. I've been saying similar things for some time, that the very notion of blackness was a colonial European invention. The West Africans identified as Wolof or Akan or Igbo or whatever, not as black. Black was a way of totalizing all of these people.
Yes.
And assigning them a certain kind of inferior status, lumping them together. So, yeah, absolutely right. And the choice of black, although I don't think it was deliberate, I think these things sort of happen. So, look, the folks who did the colonization, they had a kind of a problem that they saw immense opportunities for profit. But they also had this view that human beings, as human beings, are owed a certain sort of respect. And so the solution was to demote West Africans from full humanity. And to do that, they invoked Aristotle's ancient notion of natural slaves and really told a story to themselves that somehow they were doing these people a favor by enslaving them. So they found that it was very easy then to relieve this sort of tension by assuming that this population was not fully human or was actually subhuman and benefited from this unimaginably cruel and barbaric treatment.
Perhaps what we should do, Garrett Duncan, is where do we go from here?
The youth are leading the way. We might want to follow the youth. Most of the changes in our society around the matters of race have been led by youth, whether it was through hip-hop, the Black Panther Party, or through mothers who gave birth to these youth. And I'll give an example of the Black Panther Party, seen as this violent militant group. We have to keep in mind that militancy means strong advocacy for something, but the term militant has been given a particular notion to mask what is going on. Many of us, so when we say Black Lives Matter, inherently all lives matter in that sense. To give the example of the Black Panther Party that I was going to use, our free and reduced lunch programs in the United States, that these programs that are available to folks regardless of their skin color or their racial category or their ethnic profile, that originated in the free and reduced lunch program of the Black Panther Party, and it was taken up by the U.S. federal government at the chagrin of J. Edgar Hoover, who was really upset by that. So most folks do not realize that many of the public goods that we have originated in the struggles of Black folks. And there's a saying that we often hear, the revolution will not be televised. That may be true, but it will be Facebook and Twitter, or tweeted, I should say. And so what we're having right now has been going on for quite a while, the violence and the angst, but now there are new narratives and counter-narratives being brought up as a result of social media and other folks being able to have the media to speak for themselves in and on their own terms. And I think if the past serves us any type of recognition, I think that will augur well for the future of this country.
We will have to continue this down the line and discuss where we need to go. So let me thank the two of you now. Thank you so much for joining us again on the Scholar Circle. Wonderful to have you both again.
It was my pleasure, and thank you for inviting me.
Professor David Livingston Smith teaches philosophy at the University of New England. He's written 7 books, and his most recent is called Less Than Human: Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. Garrett Albert Duncan is a professor of education in arts and science and holds an appointment in African and African-American studies at the Washington University in St. Louis. Professor Duncan studies schooling as a moral enterprise, exploring the intersection of moral and political contexts in our education systems. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.